Welcome to The Economist, the weekly business news magazine from Great Britain on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the April 18th, 2026 edition of the magazine. This week's cover is a line drawing of a tiny futuristic robot standing in a very large room or museum space, staring up at a gigantic mural of toga-clad Greek godlike marble sculptures, each with a 21st century technological device, a cell phone, a laptop, or a virtual reality helmet. And it looks like a romanticized tableau of the ancient titans of an earlier technological era. Upon closer inspection, those toga-clad figures appear to be artificial intelligence leaders we know today. Leo Emode of Anthropic, Demis Hassabis of Google DeepMind, Elon Musk of XAI, Mark Zuckerberg of Meta AI, and Sam Altman of OpenAI. And the headline reads, "The Mythos Moment. Can five men be trusted with AI?" And that, of course, is the cover lead article this week, "America Wakes Up to AI's Dangerous Power." And the other five leader articles we'll be reading this week, "Hungary's Elections. Peter Magyar's Victory Will Keep Hungary in the Spotlight." "Blockage Heads. How to End the War in Iran." "Caracas Conditions. Donald Trump has made Venezuela a better place." "Tax Day Mayday. America will come to regret its war on taxes." And "A Slow Motion Tragedy. The impending global food shock is inevitable." Those leader articles will be followed by Chapter 4 of America at 250, War and the Making of a Superpower. And with time available at the end, we'll also look at some other international articles. Now, let's turn to our cover leader article. "America Wakes Up to AI's Dangerous Power." After Mythos, a laissez-faire approach is no longer politically tenable or strategically wise. Should a handful of men be entrusted with the world's most potent new technology? Five geeks so famous that they can be identified by their first names, Dario, Demis, Elon, Mark, and Sam, exercise almost godlike command over the artificial intelligence models that will shape the future. The Trump administration has stood aside, even as those models have gained jaw-dropping capabilities, convinced that unfettered competition between private firms is the best way to ensure America wins the AI race against China. Until now. Suddenly, America's freewheeling treatment of AI looks as if it is coming to an end. The reason is that the model's dizzying progress also poses a threat to America's own national security, unnerving members of the Trump administration previously more inclined to worry about overregulation. At the same time, growing resentment among American voters is turning AI into a political lightning rod. A laissez-faire approach is no longer politically tenable or strategically wise. The watershed was Anthropic's announcement of Claude Mythos on April 7th. The model maker's latest creation is so startlingly good at finding software vulnerabilities that, in the wrong hands, it would threaten critical infrastructure, from banks to hospitals. AI models increasingly pose other risks too, from biosecurity hazards to industrial-scale scamming. Anthropic's boss, Dario Amodei, wisely thought Mythos too dangerous for general release. Instead, he has reserved it for use by around 50 big firms in computing, software, and finance so that they can boost their own defenses. America's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was so unnerved that he summoned the biggest banks for urgent talks. It was not the first time the administration had acted. Only weeks ago, the Pentagon stepped in after Mr. Amodei refused to allow Anthropic's model to be used in fully autonomous weapons or for mass domestic surveillance. Then, too, the Trump administration was alarmed because of the power a single firm wielded over a technology central to national security. A backlash among voters will add to the pressure on the administration to intervene. Opinion polls are leading ever more politicians to think that AI will be one of the big issues in elections in 2028. Americans are far more skeptical of AI than people in other countries. 7 out of 10 think AI will hurt job opportunities, a sharp rise from a year ago, and well before they had good evidence. Grassroots opposition to data centers is surging, even though AI has little or nothing to do with rising electricity prices. In a sign of the times, the house of Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, has been attacked twice in recent days. History suggests that, with a technology as world-changing as AI, a mythos moment was inevitable. From John D. Rockefeller to Henry Ford, America's great industrial innovations were led by a small number of men who grew immensely powerful. Eventually, 20th century governments stepped in to tame overpowerful industries, from the trust busting that broke up Standard Oil to the creation of the Federal Reserve and the breakup of AT&T. Those times were at least as polarized and febrile as today's are. And our calculations suggest that the AI gods are not yet any more dominant than their historical predecessors were. But history also suggests that controlling AI will be fraught. That is partly because the stakes, if things go wrong, are so high. It's also because AI is evolving at warp speed. The trade-offs are acute. Economic growth will benefit from rapidly diffusing AI's benefits, but the potential backlash could easily lead to overregulation. Doing nothing could leave America vulnerable to malevolent AI-induced chaos, but regulatory overkill would ensure that China wins the AI race. That makes a perilous moment. Time is short. 2 years ago, during the Biden administration, discussions about regulation were largely about AI's potential risks. Today, its capabilities are already alarmingly powerful and growing more so with every release. The pace of innovation means that debates over the proper role of government, which played out over years, even decades in the past, now need to be resolved in months. And the technical hurdles to a more interventionist approach are daunting. Tools of government control, such as nationalization, are ineffective because talented engineers can move freely between companies and computing power is a commodity. Worse, the leading model builders are only months ahead of their open source competitors, including those in China. Sooner or later, the capabilities of their models will be available to all. Even so, the mythos moment could be when a workable scheme to control AI starts to take shape. Trusted users would get early access to the most powerful new models. OpenAI is following Anthropic by rolling out its latest tool to a limited group of vetted cybersecurity professionals. Before allowing those models to be broadly commercialized, the government could demand certification from industry-led bodies that have tested them for different uses. This idea has advantages for the big model builders and government alike. It avoids the lengthy process of creating a new regulator. By allowing only a few premium users, it enables the model makers to charge higher prices and limit the use of scarce computing power. Meanwhile, the government can restrict who can use the most powerful models, reducing the risk that China can copy them and catch up faster. But it also suffers from grave problems. Limited release will reduce competition and increase the clout of entrenched AI companies. It will slow the diffusion of AI's benefits and create a two-tier system within America's economy, disadvantaging the many firms that are repeatedly deprived of privileged early access to powerful new models. What if making AI defenses takes a long time or is impossible? What about open source models? How can you insist that they also follow these rules? A regulatory system built on these foundations could prove unjust. Insiders could secure themselves against frontier threats. Outsiders would have to hope for the best. The opportunities for lobbying and outsized profits would be immense. That would test the honesty and competence of the most openly corrupt administration of America's modern political era. And a fix that concentrates power and wealth yet further among a handful of AI gods risks aggravating the very political backlash that is starting to worry Washington. Moreover, the Mythos approach can only be half the solution. AI safety cannot be secured nationally. Eventually, it will demand international cooperation, starting with China. The new focus on cybersecurity also needs to be matched by urgent thinking about the economic and social effects of AI. Dealing with the disruption to jobs and designing new AI-adapted tax systems that favor labor are huge problems for which no one yet has good answers. This needs to change. The Mythos moment is a wake-up call for AI safety. It demands hard thinking in other areas, too. That was America Wakes Up to AI's Dangerous Power. Second leader article, Hungary's elections. Peter Magyar's victory will keep Hungary in the spotlight. Country will become a test case for reversing democratic decay. Viktor Orban, Hungary's corpulent prime minister, reveled in his role as the champion of the growing band of populist nations in Europe and beyond. Only days before a general election on April 12th, America's Vice President J.D. Vance visited Hungary to proclaim that a vote for Mr. Orban was a vote for Western civilization. Mr. Orban's crushing defeat in that election was a rebuke to the VEEP's arrogant nonsense. But it also means that the election's triumph and solidly conservative winner, Peter Magyar, will be seized on by centrists and progressives as a case study in how to reverse democratic decay. One conclusion is that nothing turns the page like an overwhelming victory. After years of chipping away at Hungary's independent institutions, Mr. Orban could have aped Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil and Donald Trump of America by contesting a close result. In the event, with his Fidesz party on track to win just 40% of the votes and 56 seats, compared with 52% and 137 seats for Mr. Magyar and Tisza, the Budapest bulldozer had the grace to concede promptly. Mr. Magyar will now command a two-thirds majority in the parliament, just as Fidesz did. That gives him the legal power to amend the constitution, unless the president risks voters' anger by vetoing every amendment. During 16 years in charge, Mr. Orban jammed Fidesz into every corner of the state. The party controls the Supreme and Constitutional Courts. Its allies own most of the broadcast, online, and print media. It has apparatchiks throughout the civil service, in state-owned companies, and the education system. A second conclusion is that voters are more susceptible to arguments about corruption and economic competence than to warnings about inchoate tyranny. On the campaign trail, Mr. Magyar never tired of pointing out to Hungarians how Mr. Orban and his cronies were making out like bandits. And that is precisely because they were bandits. Rigged public contracts, favors from regulators under Fidesz's thumb, and the diversion of European Union subsidies all fattened the wallets of those favored by Mr. Orban. Voters want Mr. Magyar to restore the rule of law, revive Hungary's economy, and eradicate corruption and the crooks who benefit from it. Because the Fidesz machine could yet hinder his ability to govern, Mr. Magyar should be ruthless in dismantling its controls. He must also act quickly. Poland, which voted in a new government in 2023, has demonstrated how hard it can be to repair the damage caused by years of populist rule. But Mr. Magyar must also be magnanimous in the reconstruction that follows. TISA did not win its victory alone. Nearly all the other opposition groups in Hungary, conservative, liberal, and leftist, laid down their standards to unite behind Mr. Magyar. They need to share in the new Hungary, too. A third conclusion is that nobody likes foreign interference. That applies to Mr. Vance, who warned of the malign intentions of bureaucrats from Brussels, only to find that meddlers from MAGA are not wildly popular either. But it also applies to Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, who has courted Hungary with cheap energy and special favors, and to China's president, Xi Jinping, who has seen Hungary as a gateway to Europe. By rejecting Russian and American efforts to influence their votes, a majority showed that they want to belong in that least fashionable sphere of influence, the EU. The responsibility for putting all this right falls upon the new leader, Mr. Magyar, remains something of a mystery. He defected from Mr. Orban's camp only 2 years ago. As a campaigner, he was extraordinary, crisscrossing the country to hold rallies against Fidesz and unite a broad coalition behind TISA. In office, he deserves help. Now that Hungarians have elected a government bound to abide by the law, Europe should quickly unlock the billions of euros it has withheld from the country. That might seem like another form of foreign interference, but Hungary freely decided to become an EU member and to follow its rules. Mr. Magyar has an awesome task ahead. Liberals everywhere will be rooting for him. That was Hungary's elections. Peter Magyar's victory will keep Hungary in the spotlight. Third leader article this week is Blockade Heads: How to End the War in Iran. America and Iran must resume their efforts to strike a deal, even though it is sure to be an imperfect one. Be grateful for small mercies. The ceasefire between America and Iran may be extended. Talks that began in Islamabad last weekend may soon resume. Though the Strait of Hormuz is closed, oil markets are no more spooked than they were, and though economic damage is spreading, a deep Hormuz-induced global recession could yet be averted. But small mercies are not enough. If they are not to return to a futile war, America and Iran will have to ensure the ceasefire produces a lasting peace by opening the strait and settling their dispute over Iran's nuclear program. That will require compromise and a willingness to grapple with complexity that has eluded both sides, especially President Donald Trump. The search for peace starts with a reckoning of America's leverage. Mr. Trump's recent imposition of his own blockade was an attempt to strengthen his hand after weeks of bombardment failed to force Iran's capitulation. It traps tankers taking as much as 2 million barrels a day of Iranian oil to market even as war raged. The idea is to use the economy to get Iran's hardliners to give ground. It is a less harmful tactic than the many bad ideas America's president has aired in recent weeks, bombing power plants, sending troops to be sitting ducks on Karg Island, or wrecking the oil industry. A dire economy was Iran's greatest weakness before the war began. Mass protests in January were the result of fury over the currency's collapse, shortages, and joblessness. American and Israeli bombs have worsened all those things and made the regime even more desperate for sanctions relief. The blockade's success, however, is highly uncertain. Such measures usually take months, even years, to force compliance. The regime is desperate to alleviate sanctions and knows that this is the best chance to strike a good bargain. That may mean it is prepared to endure the blockade for longer. Mr. Trump may lose patience as petrol prices surge for American consumers. What matters most, therefore, is whether talks can produce a deal. The first stage is reopening the strait, which should be possible for Iran and America to agree on. After all, each side knows it could force closure again. In no circumstance should America agree to let Iran levy tolls on shipping traversing the waters. That would give it a permanent hold over the rest of the region. There will have to be an argument in which America may have to trade the lifting of some sanctions in return for safe passage. The second stage will be about Iran's nuclear program. The outlines of a deal are simple here, too. Iran must close off its path to a nuclear weapon in return for more sanctions relief. Unfortunately, everything about the deal will be tricky. The two sides do not trust each other, so neither will take bold steps, fearful that the other might not later honor its part of a deal. A willingness to compromise may also be lacking, because both sides want to portray a total victory at the negotiating table as a substitute for the total victory they could not achieve on the field of battle. Last, as nearly 2 years of negotiations for the deal with Iran in 2015 attest, nailing down the details of a nuclear program will be fiendishly complex. At issue is Iran's stock of roughly 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium and its capacity to enrich more. America wants the stock of uranium removed from the country and a ban on fresh enrichment. Iran wants relief from sanctions and to be able to enrich, a symbol of sovereignty that it would find hard to surrender. Compromises are available. Iran could dilute the uranium to a low level suitable for civilian use. It could forswear enrichment for a long but limited time, or it could enrich uranium as part of a consortium. Iran would not get all sanctions lifted, but some limited Iranian financial assets held abroad could be unfrozen. To be credible, such a deal needs international monitors. Even if Iran is not enriching, it must face limits on the number and caliber of its centrifuges on theoretical work, given that post-war Iran has even more incentive to dash for a bomb. The danger is that Iran will drag out talks hoping to screw more out of America, but end up with nothing. Even if the two sides reach an agreement, there will be no room for triumphalism. Iran will remain a threatening presence in the Middle East. Its embittered, insecure regime has discovered that it can use Hormuz and regional strikes as weapons. America has discovered that going to war with Iran is perilous. Much work will be needed to rebuild the Gulf's security infrastructure and its economies, including Iran. Before America and Israel started bombing, a decent agreement may already have been within reach. It's hard to see the sum of what comes out of the fighting being any better. That was Blockade Heads, How to End the War in Iran. Moving on to our fourth leader article, The Caracas Condition. Donald Trump has made Venezuela a better place, but the American president is misinterpreting an incomplete success. Before its strongman leader Nicolas Maduro was captured by American special forces on January 3rd, Venezuela was a grim, hopeless place. His regime silenced critics and stole elections. Some opposition politicians were killed, tortured, or thrown into jail. The economy had collapsed. 8 million people had fled. The notion of Venezuela spontaneously becoming more open or prosperous seemed too much to hope for. But in the 100 days since Mr. Maduro's seizure, Venezuela has changed for the better. Opposition politicians, many only just released from prison, are meeting openly. Protests are no longer routinely suppressed. Investors are sniffing around oil, gas, and mining assets. Delcy Rodriguez, previously Mr. Maduro's deputy, is running the country to Donald Trump's liking, albeit under the threat of violence if she fails to comply. None of this would have happened without Mr. Trump. But the president is muddled about what Venezuela shows in two important ways. The first is that he talks about the country's transformation as though it were complete, speaking of how Venezuela has worked out so incredibly. The second is that he holds Venezuela up as a model for regime change. What we did in Venezuela, Mr. Trump said in March, when asked about his plans for Iran, I think is the perfect scenario. On both counts, he's wrong. For one thing, Venezuela's positive transformation is only limited so far. It will not be secure until democracy has been rekindled. Foreign investment will not pour in at the scale needed while the rule of law is backed only by Mr. Trump's word that he will keep the regime's cronies in line. What's more, having had their hopes dramatically raised, Venezuelans will bridle without more progress away from dictatorship. Those jails still hold some 480 political prisoners. Investors want stability. Delaying elections will eventually cause unrest. The return of democracy is a possibility. However, the path towards it is narrow and murky, and without sustained American pressure, it may vanish altogether. It probably requires Maria Corina Machado, leader of the opposition, to return to Venezuela and campaign for election. After she was barred from standing in the presidential vote in 2024, Venezuelans voted overwhelmingly for her political ally, Edmundo Gonzalez. Mr. Maduro pretended he had won. This time, Venezuelans may have to take to the streets at the same time as seeking negotiations with those in power. The threat of his big foreign policy success being marred by protesters angrily demanding change may motivate Mr. Trump to press for elections. Marco Rubio, his Cuban-American Secretary of State, also has staked much on Venezuela's success, including his own presidential ambitions. But the long game is hardly a Trumpian strength. Besides, Ms. Rodriguez will surely seek to string things out, hoping that Mr. Trump will lose interest. The temptation for America to trade democratic delay for short-term stability will be strong. Even if Mr. Trump and his officials can nurture a democratic Venezuela, his methods are not easily reproduced elsewhere. The Venezuelan regime was uniquely vulnerable to Mr. Trump's transactional approach because it has long been corrupt and ideologically free. Mr. Maduro was no more than a gangster in chief. By removing him, Mr. Trump helped others profit more. With few shared beliefs beyond grabbing power and money, it cost them little to fall in line with America. Venezuela's history of democracy and its robust political opposition also aided Mr. Trump by giving Venezuelans a group apart from the regime to rally around. Most interpreted Mr. Maduro's seizure narrowly as an attack on a hated dictator. Contrast this with Mr. Trump's failed attempts to topple the regime in Iran. The strike at the start of the war that killed Ali Khamenei, the country's supreme leader, prompted the rest of the regime in Tehran to close ranks and fight back. However corrupt and self-serving the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps may be, a shared ideology helped prevent the regime from fracturing. By contrast, Ms. Rodriguez's deal with the Americans was consistent with self-serving values of Mr. Maduro. Iran's regime is far more powerful than the one in Venezuela, but even tiny Cuba has so far held out against Mr. Trump's aggression. For 66 years, the island has been run by the Castro family, who are true believers in communism, regardless of the country's corruption. Neither the regime in Cuba nor that in Iran faces an organized domestic political opposition. Mr. Trump sees ideology as weakness. He thinks making money is all that really counts. If he keeps following the model he stumbled into in Venezuela, reality will prove him wrong. That was the Caracas Condition. Donald Trump has made Venezuela a better place. You're listening to The Economist magazine. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you miss any part of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it from our website, sunsounds.org, or from our SunSounds mobile app, available for both Apple and Android phones. Now, let's move on to our fifth leader article, Tax Day Mayday. America will come to regret its war on taxes. Lately, Democrats have joined the charge. Beware any policy that is overwhelmingly popular. That usually means it has not been properly scrutinized. The latest example is taxes in America. The country is in the grip of a bipartisan tax-cutting mania. Tax filing season has just closed, and Americans are receiving hefty refunds from Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill, financed by trillions of dollars in deficit spending. Not to be outdone, two Democrats in the Senate, Cory Booker and Chris Van Hollen, have put forward their own plans, which, if implemented, would mean around 55% of tax filers would pay no federal income taxes. Unsurprisingly, those proposals poll tremendously well. Giveaways are always appealing, and Americans are particularly disenchanted with the tax system at the moment. Perceptions of tax fairness are at a 30-year low. Zany ideas are bouncing around at the state level, too. See, for example, the wave of property tax exemptions for old folks, or a proposal in Georgia to eliminate income taxes that is specifically reserved for teachers. This newspaper is certainly no fan of big government, but it's foolish to think that ordinary Americans should be exempt from taxes. For the burden to be bundled into a disfavored few, be they foreigners via tariffs, in Republican plans, or the rich in the Democratic ones, as in California's mooted 5% wealth tax on billionaires, would be economically unrealistic and politically corrosive. First, the economics. It's hard to argue that Americans are overtaxed. Barring some Democratic-run states, America has low taxes compared with most other rich nations. The tax code is already progressive, making it more so would distort the incentive to earn. And America is running budget deficits worth 6% of its GDP, the highest on record outside recession or wartime. The Congressional Budget Office, a fiscal watchdog, expects that figure to keep rising. So, this is a bad time for both parties to enter an irresponsible spiral. At the IMF spring meetings in Washington this week, economists were beginning to wonder when, rather than if, America will suffer a bond market reckoning worthy of Liz Truss, briefly Britain's prime minister. As emerging market finance ministers have long known and their counterparts in Europe are rediscovering, living under the bond market's microscope is not pleasant. Then, take the politics. The notion that tax giveaways will buy politicians lasting popularity is dubious. Mr. Trump's first-term tax cuts did not prevent him from being beaten in 2020. His approval ratings have kept sliding during this refund season, too. Rishi Sunak, Ms. Truss's successor, jammed through payroll tax cuts worth 0.7% of GDP ahead of his bruising election loss in 2024. When British voters were polled about his list of achievements, they ranked those tax cuts below banning the XL bully, a nasty sort of dog. Democrats hope that cutting taxes will assuage voters' concerns about affordability. Yet that angst does not reflect actual falls in purchasing power. Wage growth for the average American has outstripped inflation for years. Instead, voters keep getting sticker shock from high nominal prices. Padding incomes by lowering taxes won't fix that problem. Removing so many Americans from the tax base entirely, as the latest Democratic ideas propose, sounds nice, but comes with an additional downside. Taxes, if not quite the price of civilization, do give citizens a reason to care about efficient and effective government. Severing that connection and leaving large chunks of the electorate as mere recipients of state largesse risks deepening America's political dysfunction. And that would be lamentable on its own terms and put the mature political conversation about its fiscal choices that America needs even further out of reach. That was Tax Day Mayday. America will come to regret its war on taxes. Now, our final leader article this week. A slow motion tragedy. The impending global food shock is preventable. So why won't it be prevented? 4 years ago, the world averted a humanitarian catastrophe, or seemed to. One giant cereal producer, Russia, invaded another, Ukraine. Fears of food shortages spread in poor countries unable to pay suddenly astronomical prices for wheat and other staples. Then the two foes agreed to let grain-laden ships sail from their Black Sea ports. Markets calmed. Hunger vanished from the headlines, but not from destitute lives. The Ukraine war is thought to have killed more people in the global south than on the battlefields of Eastern Europe. Now, a war in the Gulf threatens a similar slow-motion calamity outside the theater of conflict. The poor in Africa and Asia are already growing less on their plots and skipping meals. The UN's World Food Program warns that if the Strait of Hormuz is not open by mid-year, more than 300 million people who already struggle to feed themselves will be joined by another 45 million. The world could help avert this outcome. The tragic reality is it won't. Although Iran and its neighbors are not big food exporters, they are a critical link in agricultural supply chains. The blockaded region sells 30% of globally traded fertilizer, 20% of liquefied natural gas used as feedstock in making fertilizer and as fuel for cooking, plus 15% of oil needed to power farm equipment. If the nearly 2 million tons of fertilizer stuck behind the blockaded strait does not start moving soon, many crops will not be nourished at the right time in the growing season. Yields will plummet, prices will rise, and many poor city dwellers will go hungry. Fertilizer shortages will hurt the poor world's agribusiness more than its subsistence farmers, who use little of the stuff anyway. But countrysides will bear the brunt of a geophysical disaster that is about to compound the geopolitical one. The world is due to be hit by an El Niño, a weather pattern that temporarily warms the planet every few years and creates a pattern of droughts and floods around the world. This one could be especially powerful. So the gentler effects of El Niño outside the tropics can help farmers there. In poorer places, its consequences are all too often bad. Argentina and Uruguay tend to get too much rain. Southern Africa, India, and Southeast Asia, too little. The Super El Niño in 2015-2016 caused food crop production to decline by up to two-thirds in some southern African countries. The last El Niño in 2023-24 brought the worst drought in 100 years to the region as a whole. Crops failed and thousands of cattle and other livestock died. According to the World Bank, more than 30 million people required food assistance. The true strength of this year's El Niño will not become clear until the northern summer, but one thing is already certain. Super or not, it will layer on top of accelerating global warming, which makes dry regions drier and wet ones wetter. This will thus stack extremes on top of extremes of weather and of poverty. The worst could yet be averted. Much of the needed fertilizer already exists, and there is still time in some regions to apply it to this year's crops. Though no amount of urea can save a crop ripped out by a landslide or singed by drought, careful application can limit some of El Niño's ravages. The world is not short of calories either. Lots of the corn, maize, that's converted into ethanol for cars could instead feed humans. And even as rich countries' governments spend money to spare their citizens from the fuel shock caused by the war in the Gulf, they have the means to pay for food assistance in the poor world. So much for the theory. Iran should allow fertilizer to pass through the Straits of Hormuz. America should not blockade urea shipments from Iran. Tragically, neither shows any inclination to do so. High petrol prices make biofuel more attractive to farmers, not less. and rich countries are in a selfish mood. Failure to act thus looks baked in. In the face of an avoidable disaster, that is shameful. That was A Slow Motion Tragedy. The impending global food shock is preventable. Next, we'll move to Chapter 4 of the America at 250 special article series. Chapter 4 is titled War and the Making of a Superpower, 1914 to 1945. A World in Conflict, A Nation Uncertain, 1917 to 1920. The world must be made safe for democracy. With those words to Congress on April 2, 1917, Woodrow Wilson called for the country to enter the First World War. He was also articulating a moral and political justification for the projection of American power abroad that would endure into the 21st century. In foreign policy, American liberalism would come to be characterized by a struggle between Wilsonian thinking, interventionist, idealistic, and a more isolationist impulse that countries should mind their own affairs. In the First World War, Wilson's intervention proved decisive, as American troops and industrial output tipped a long, bloody stalemate in the Allies' favor. His idealism had less immediate purchase. The president's vision for a new world order, embodied in a League of Nations that would provide for collective security and lower trade barriers, collapsed amid political squabbling at home. The League came into being, but was a dead letter without America as a member. It would take another, more deadly world war for some of its ideas to be put into practice. The Suffragettes' War, 1920. Wilson's idealistic rhetoric for entering the war provoked a backlash at home from suffragettes who argued that his commitment to democracy abroad did not extend to half the population at home. In protests outside the White House, women called the president Kaiser Wilson and burned copies of his speeches. When the protesters were jailed, they went on hunger strikes, drawing more national attention. Wilson finally buckled when it became clear that women were powering the industrial war effort at home while men fought overseas. By 1920, enough states had ratified the 19th Amendment to add it to the Constitution. Britain, we hasten to note, had moved earlier, extending the vote to millions of women in 1918. Hooray for Hollywood. In 1915, Carl Laemmle, a German-Jewish immigrant, started making moving pictures at Universal City near Los Angeles, where a film business had begun to sprout far from the patent-enforcing thugs of Thomas Edison, a pioneer of motion picture technology. In the years that followed, Louis B. Mayer and four brothers of the Warner family, likewise Jewish immigrants, set up their own studios. A distinctly American creation was born, Hollywood. It became the wellspring of arguably America's greatest liberal strength, its soft power. During the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, Hollywood projected a glamorous vision of American life in films such as Our Dancing Daughters, It Happened One Night, Gone with the Wind, and The Philadelphia Story. That many Jews and other immigrants produced and starred in these films only made Hollywood more American still. Roaring into modernity, the 1920s. In the 1920s, America reaped the fruits of decades of liberal progress in social mores, technology, and institutions. Henry Ford's introduction of assembly line production in 1913 had, by the 1920s, cut the cost of cars and other goods enough to create a broad consumer market. Mass production also expanded office work, much of it taken up by women who became more independent. Radio, though a European, we would argue British, invention, exploded in America. Advertising flooded the airwaves, marketing an aspirational, affluent way of life. And easy money, thanks to a loose credit policy under the still new Federal Reserve, made the American dream attainable to millions. Modern consumer culture was born. Fashion-forward women became flappers. Black musicians in cities ushered in the jazz age. Young couples drove their cheap Model Ts, paid on the installment loan for picnics in the countryside. Black market liquor at speakeasies lubricated all the fun. Surely the good times would roll on forever, right? The end of the ride, 1929. Nothing better captured the roaring 20s than the investment craze on Wall Street, which had become the epicenter of American and global prosperity. Regular punters and big firms alike borrowed ever more heavily to speculate and boost returns. But in October 1929, the market crashed, helping tick the world into the Great Depression. America's response made matters worse. In 1930, Congress passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff to protect manufacturers, starting a damaging trade war. The Federal Reserve worried about inflation, tightened the money supply as debt soured, deepening the downturn and causing deflation instead. President Herbert Hoover, meanwhile, resisted offering federal relief to the needy. The extent of the suffering soon made clear how serious these missteps were. By 1933, one in four American adults was jobless. Nearly half of America's banks had failed, and GDP had shrunk by 30%. Let's try throwing money at the problem, 1933 to 1935. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Democratic governor of New York and Teddy's distant cousin, defeated Hoover in a landslide in November of 1932. The new president's remedy for the Depression was the New Deal in 1933, followed by the Second New Deal in 1935. The government insured bank deposits, provided relief to the jobless, introduced Social Security for seniors, strengthened labor protections, and put millions of Americans to work building roads, dams, and bridges. In his second term, Roosevelt added a minimum wage, a 44-hour work week, and overtime pay. The New Deal had plenty of doubters. In 1939, America unemployment rate was still 17%. But for most, it was a welcome respite to the excesses of laissez-faire capitalism. It also entrenched a new liberal idea that in hard times, the state should intervene more directly in the economy. The economist who gave this intellectual shape was, of course, British. John Maynard Keynes argued that when private demand collapses, government should spend more to sustain employment and growth. The lasting legacy of the New Deal is Keynesianism. Well, that and the tiresome use of New Deal branding in modern politics. The Limits of Presidential Power, 1930s edition. Roosevelt left another legacy, a radical expansion of presidential power. He entrenched the idea of leading the government by force of personality. He gave his first message to Congress in person, something Woodrow Wilson had revived, but which now became standard practice. He brought his New Deal legislation to Capitol Hill, cajoling and charming members rather than leaving Congress to set the agenda. And crucially, he sold his ideas directly to the public through his radio fireside chats, enlarging the presidency in the American imagination. In one such broadcast in July of 1933, he highlighted the passage of his New Deal in his first 100 days, a benchmark against which future presidents would be judged. Inevitably, Roosevelt overreached. When the Supreme Court kept blocking New Deal policies, he threatened to expand it with 6 new justices. His court-packing scheme provoked a backlash. His decision to run for a third and then a fourth term, breaking a long-standing 2-term custom, cemented the perception of an imperial presidency. The 22nd Amendment, ratified 6 years after his death, limited presidents to 2 elected terms, or appears to at least. Another world war so soon? 1940 to 1941. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. With these Wilsonian words in a fireside chat in December of 1940, Roosevelt explained why Americans must do more to help the British in our gallant resistance to Nazi conquest. We must have more ships, more guns, more planes, more of everything, he said. Roosevelt was arguing against the isolationist mood embodied by the America First Committee, whose most famous advocate was the aviation hero Charles Lindbergh. Roosevelt insisted that aiding Britain offered the best hope of keeping America out of the war. More plausibly, he was buying Winston Churchill time until America could join it. The two leaders laid the foundations for a new special relationship between the former colonies and the old mother country. After Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1941, a date Roosevelt said would live in infamy, America entered another world war in the name of democracy and liberty. Now, let's go save humanity, 1941 to 1945. At the time of Pearl Harbor, many Americans were still mired in the Depression. War gave the country a new purpose. More than 16 million Americans, roughly half of young men, served. The war touched almost every family, workplace, and town. Factories and shipyards turned out tanks, planes, and ships at unprecedented scale. Women joined the assembly lines. Unemployment vanished as federal spending surged. On the battlefield, Americans fought across 2 fronts. In Europe, they joined Allied forces in large-scale industrial warfare from North Africa to Normandy and beyond. In the Pacific, they faced brutal island-by-island combat at places such as Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima. America's fighting relied on overwhelming firepower, complex logistics, and impressive coordination, hallmarks of the most advanced army the world had seen. America emerged from the war a more confident nation, now the world's unquestioned superpower. Having endured scarcity, Americans met a global crisis with discipline and collective effort. Those who fought are often remembered as America's greatest generation. In the name of security. It's one of the ironies of the American experiment that in wartime, presidents have repeatedly trampled on the liberties they profess to defend. During the First World War, Wilson jailed anti-war activists and labor organizers. In 1919 and 1920, his Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, conducted raids to round up thousands of suspected socialists in America's first Red Scare. During the Second World War, the Roosevelt administration interned around 120,000 people of Japanese descent, 2/3 of them American citizens, on the grounds that they might otherwise engage in espionage or sabotage. Fred Korematsu, a Japanese-American, challenged his arrest for refusing to report to the camps. The Supreme Court ruled that the War Department, not judges, should decide whether military necessity justified denying due process. Korematsu's conviction was overturned in 1983 after it emerged that officials had suppressed assessments of Japanese Americans posed no threat. The government would apologize 5 years later. The bomb. In 1939, Roosevelt received a letter written by Leo Szilard and signed by Albert Einstein, warning of the destructive potential of a bomb that harnessed the energy of a nuclear chain reaction. The physicists who had come to America as refugees feared that Germany might build such a weapon. Their message spurred Roosevelt to act, ultimately leading to the creation of the Manhattan Project. From 1943, a team of American, British, and emigre scientists labored at Los Alamos, New Mexico, to develop what their leader, Robert Oppenheimer, called the gadget. In July 1945, 2 months after Germany's surrender, they detonated the first atomic bomb in the New Mexico desert. Horrified by the result, several scientists, including Szilard, petitioned Harry Truman, who had become president upon Roosevelt's death, not to use the bomb. But America dropped one on Hiroshima on October 6th of 1945 and another on Nagasaki 3 days later. The two bombs killed around 200,000 people by the end of 1945, many from burns and radiation. Japan surrendered on August 15th. We wrote at the time that it was one more terror, which is better to have on our side, but best not to have at all. Hey, let's not have a Third World War, 1944 to 1945. The 1930s had demonstrated the perils of protectionism and nationalism. What was needed, thought Roosevelt and Churchill, was a new global economic system to ensure prosperity and trade after the war. Unsurprisingly, they intended to be in charge. In July 1944, at a hotel in Bretton Woods, a small village in New Hampshire, negotiators designed a system with America at the heart. Currencies were pegged to the dollar, and the dollar to gold. An International Monetary Fund and World Bank were created. America would be the unquestioned leader of this system. The sun was setting on the British Empire. The champions of multilateralism weren't done yet. The following April, delegates gathered in San Francisco to ratify a charter for the United Nations, with both America and its chief ideological adversary, the Soviet Union, agreeing to participate. A new world order was born. That was Chapter 4 of America at 250, War and the Making of a Superpower, 1914 to 1945. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the April 18th edition of The Economist magazine. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell, and it has been my pleasure to read them here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for another edition of The Economist, and stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.